This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This week, we saw New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft trade in righteous indignation for surrender as he accepted the NFL punishment for Deflategate. We saw Governor Charlie Baker get his way with the Senate, which approved his plan for new oversight of the troubled MBTA. We saw a change in leadership of Boston 2024. And we learned that two priceless prints disappeared from the Boston Public Library. So let's jump right into our week in review and talk about all that and the rest of the week's news with Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, always good to see
you. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. Also with us in the studio is Dante Ramos. He's a columnist for the op-ed page of the Boston Globe. And Dante, it's great that you're here. This is the first time that you and I actually see each other in the flesh. So what a treat.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for coming in. So let's start with efforts to fix the T and Governor Baker's victory last night. The state Senate approved his plan to establish a temporary financial control board for the T, which would give him a lot of authority over the beleaguered agency. Senate President Stan Rosenberg had opposed the plan but changed his mind. The governor didn't get everything he wanted, and the House and Senate still need to hammer out the detail, but he got a lot. And here he was speaking this afternoon at the State House.
And the Senate, led by the Senate president, actually produced, a pretty responsible product on that I'm assuming we'll be able to work through conference with.
So, gentlemen, this past winter laid bare the problems facing the T. Can this plan for a temporary five-member board, which the governor would have a lot of control over, get the troubled T back on track? What do you think, Jim?
Well, this is an idea that we've been big supporters of from the beginning, and I do think that the product coming out of the Senate is actually kind of interesting because it's a hybrid. It said, let's incorporate a portion of the Mass Department of Transportation Board into this control board, but giving the governor two additional picks. We think it can work if they are given the right powers, and we have not seen that yet. So we think that the control board should have the power to reopen contracts, for example, with the ride, the paratransit system, which is wildly overinflated in terms of its costs. But there are many, many aspects like that. Frankly, there has to be some ability to do some outsourcing, some privatizations. And we think that binding arbitration has to be something of the past. That's been a blockage to reform at the MBT for a very, very long time. And finally, they need to be able to set some performance metrics for their employees and hold the employees accountable for that. Those are the powers to go after, and that's all to be determined in June in conference, in discussions, and we'll know then.
All right, we'll know then. What do you think, Dante, so far? I mean, is this going to help?
I think it's a highly positive development. What we've seen this whole time with the MBTA over the course of years is essentially a sense of chaos created by everybody, you know, too many chefs, essentially. And giving the governor a level of control with this control board provides a level of accountability that hasn't really existed in the past. And I think in general, the ultimate solution to this shouldn't be all that difficult. It's a combination of improving the management authority, the ability to run the T on the part of the T's managers, a lot of what Jim was just talking about, and having that lead the way to more money for investments in equipment. And up to this point, there's been a lot of talk about reform and a lot of talk about new revenue, but in every single go-around, we end up kind of sanding away each of those points. So you get a little bit of reform and a little bit of revenue, and it never ends up satisfying anybody, and we keep having the same discussion year after year after year. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that this breaks that dynamic and puts more responsibility on the part of the governor and gives him more power to take ownership of this issue, it can only be a positive.
What about the time frame of this? This would be a temporary board, 3 to 5 years. Is that long enough to get the job done, Jim?
Well, you know, precedent in Springfield suggests that it may be long enough. They may have to renew it up to 5 years. But this time frame issue is one that I think puts to the lie some of the criticism of the control board idea. Many have said it's just an additional bureaucracy. What bureaucracy do you know that puts itself out of business by putting things right? And that's really what the goal is here. You know,
rather than a bureaucracy, right, that would be new and in place
forever.
And maybe part of the problem eventually.
And just to build on something that Dante was saying a second ago, look, we've gone through all the arbitration agreements over the last 7 years. We've spent a lot of time in Superior Court going through all these documents, 3,600 pages of this stuff. And what we found was Beverly Scott, Rich Davey, and Dan Grabowskis, the three preceding GMs there, they really worked their hearts out to try and fix the system. They just did not have the tools to do it. And that's why this question about powers and tools is essential to the success of the control board.
Dante, I want to ask you about something the Boston Globe reported on this week, and that is that the governor's report on the T, which he used as the basis for calling for this MBTA control board, overstated some of the problems at the T. He responded to that this week. Here's what he said.
Whether you agree with all of our findings and all the recommendations that were in the advisory report, or you only agree with six of them, the fundamental notion that the T is financially very insecure, that it has productivity issues, and that it needs to do a better job of deploying and spending its capital resources, I don't think anybody would dispute that.
Do you agree with that? I mean, and does it matter? I mean, it sounds like what the governor is saying is the report may have overstated some of the problems, but does it really matter?
I think it did overstate some of the problems, and in the comparison also of the T versus some of the other transit systems, you could quibble with some of the numbers that are in there. And I think politically that makes the effort for the governor to get the reform proposals he wants all the way through, it does hurt. It certainly puts the idea out there that the governor and his team are basically out to get the status quo and out to get the Carmen's Union and some of the other powers that be. That said, I don't think that it really changes the underlying recipe of what's needed, because we've known what that recipe should look like for a number of years now. It's just a question of getting it put into place.
All right. Well, let's move now from the troubled tea to Boston's troubled Olympic bed. This week...
a lot of optimism on the show.
Okay. I'm going to be optimistic. Big effort today to improve Boston's Olympic bid. This week, Boston 2024, the private group behind the bid to host the Games in Boston, replaced their chair, construction magnate John Fish, with Celtics co-owner and former Bain Capital executive Steve Pagliuca. Boston 2024 has faced criticism over a lack of transparency, a sense that they're not making the sale to the citizens of Boston. Can Pagliuca turn that around? What do you think, Dante?
I think Pagliuca will prove to be a less polarizing figure than John Fish was as a matter of personality. That said, I don't believe that Boston 2024's problem is only a PR problem. I think that there are some substantive issues that they really haven't worked out. If you look back at New York's bid for the 2012 Olympics, they had done a lot more planning at this point in the game than it seems that Boston has. And at this point, it seems like the Boston 2024 group, they're almost pulling an all-nighter. They're trying to get their venue plans down. They're trying to get their infrastructure plans down. They've got the governor breathing down their neck. They've got Mayor Walsh, who has been previously a very strong supporter, clearly looking impatient and worried about something that he could end up wearing if it ends up being unsuccessful. And then they've got this sense of uncertainty now from the U.S. Olympic Committee that seems less than completely resolute in its commitment to Boston. So I worry that even with new leadership, and I say this as somebody who likes many aspects of the Olympic proposal, I worry that they're racing against the clock. Mm. The perception that they're trying to patch something together at the last minute is not something that is going to promote great PR. So with Pagliuca at the helm, it may soften up the image a little bit, but they've still got this underlying problem.
Right, some big problems. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I completely agree that Steve Pagliuca is a less polarizing figure. He's a background guy. He knows finance. He's not brash. He's not controversial. He'll work the back channels to try and get everything kind of set up and hopefully smoothen over some of the issues that we've seen over the past. I was surprised in the Globe story that I read that he is only doing this part-time. That jumped off the page for me, that this is a full-time
job. I hadn't taken
job.
That in.
Yeah. And it's to Dante's point, this is one where they are running, you know, against the clock every single day. And if you're doing this part-time, man, I hope he's got a great team that he's assembled at this point. I sincerely mean that, because I'm skeptical about the Olympics. By the same token, I see some huge upside if we could ever get it right.
You know, I want to pick up on a point that Dante made, and that is this continuing uncertainty about just how, sort of committed the USOC is to Boston's bid. This week, the city council heard from USOC board member and former Olympian Angela Ruggiero, who said this about Boston's bid.
The USOC is going through a similar vetting process to ensure that Boston's the right city. So there's no guarantee that Boston will be the city in September.
So that statement really surprised a lot of people. It sounds like the USOC doesn't have total confidence in Boston's bid. Officially, the USOC says that's not true. But doesn't this sound like kind of a huge thing to be raising doubts about, Dante?
Absolutely. One of the problems in this situation, and again, it's something that I think makes a positive outcome less likely, is that you have the USOC looking warily at Boston 2024. At the same time, Charlie Baker and Marty Walsh are looking warily at 2024 and each other. And there's a division of leadership on this issue that makes it very difficult, I think, for a unified, sound bid to come out of it.
Yeah. And Jim, I guess it doesn't help, too, that opposition remains still sort of strong in the city as well.
No, I agree with that. I think the thing is, for Steve Pagliuca's job, number one, is to create certainty in a time of uncertainty. Mm. And that means putting out a real plan. That's what the Baker administration's asked for. That's what the speaker's asked for. That's what the Senate president's asked for. People want that. I think in messaging that as he rolls it out, we hope he's able to roll it out. He needs to have a PR angle, which is he is open to changing things here and there. He has to have some hard numbers associated. There were some really soft numbers we saw in the original plan as we looked at it. On the revenue side, about $600 million that, frankly, I couldn't explain to myself where they came from. Some of the estimates around the construction were, $1 billion to construct and then actually decompose. Mm. I just don't know if those numbers were ones I found convincing. So he's got some real work there to create certainty, and that's the best thing he could do for the Olympics.
All right. Well, another big story this week is this sort of mystery of missing prints from the Boston Public Library that I want to talk a little bit about. So this week, a BPL employee is on administrative leave after the discovery that two artworks worth more than $600,000 had disappeared possibly as long as a year ago. It was an etching of Adam and Eve by Durer and a self-portrait by Rembrandt. Boston police are investigating this as a possible inside job. And yesterday we spoke with Michael Blanding, who literally wrote a book on the security at public libraries. He's a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute at Brandeis and author of The Map Thief, about the theft of rare maps from libraries. And here's what he told us.
There are hundreds, if not thousands, of items that are worth significant amounts of money that are in the back rooms of these library shelves. And in some cases, the libraries don't even fully know the extent of their collection. So these things are vulnerable.
Interesting mystery. And it raises questions about the BPL, libraries in general, if they're doing enough to secure these treasures. Dante, what do you take away from this story?
Well, let me first give you the most Pollyannish take on it possible, which is that I think the disappearance of these works speaks to the richness and the volume of culturally valuable works that are sitting in dusty back rooms in Boston cultural institutions. And I don't say that in a flippant way. I think that we have a tradition in the city of having these works available for public inspection to those who know where they are and want them. There is a risk that goes along with that. And I'm quite sure, especially knowing that this has happened, that there are steps that the Boston Public Library and other, of the many other esteemed institutions in this town that are in a similar situation can take to prevent future occurrences of this. But on the other hand, having these works available for inspection by human eyes, by real scholars, is a real positive and something that I hope doesn't get squashed out in the response to this.
Yeah, Jim, that Dante raises a really interesting thing that I wanted to ask about. To me, the sort of quick response to this story is, my God, what's happening over the BPL? And we have to talk about more security. On the other hand, you don't want to make libraries inaccessible to the public.
No, I agree. But I guess the inventory system and some of the other aspects of this really worry me. Is it just filed incorrectly or is it lost? That's just something that's going wrong at BPL. And I'd say, look, this is something that I always find remarkable. If I'm driving around and you're driving through even upstate New York or all across Massachusetts, eastern seaboard states, there are all these little museums and libraries, mm-hmm. all these small college, liberal arts colleges that have memorabilia, maps and historical, letters and stuff. And they're worth a lot of money. And it would surprise the heck out of you to go to one of these little places and find they've got stuff that's worth millions of dollars. And I think we actually do have to do some thinking about how we preserve those while we also preserve the ability of human eyes and human hands to some degree to get near them. So this is a big issue. It's a big issue for Massachusetts, especially with this incredibly rich history.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the story that never seems to lose air, despite its name. And of course, I'm talking about Deflategate of the New England Patriots. Pat's owner, Robert Kraft, this week did an about-face and surrendered to the NFL's sanctions against his team, a $1 million fine and the loss of two draft picks for deflating footballs in the AFC Championship game. He said he's accepting Commissioner Roger Goodell's punishment for the sake of the whole NFL. Here's what he said.
So, in that spirit, I don't want to continue the rhetoric that's gone on for the last 4 months. I'm going to accept, reluctantly, what he has given to us and not continue this dialogue and rhetoric. And we won't appeal.
So he won't appeal for the good of the whole league, but I have to believe if he thought he could win that appeal, he might go in a different direction. But Dante, is Kraft basically admitting, yeah, well, kind of, we cheated, sort of, yeah, let's move on.
I don't think he would put it that way, and he totally didn't, but I agree with you completely. It's the kind of statement that you make if you are caught doing something that you shouldn't do and you want to make your decision to not appeal. It seemed like a noble effort on the part of the league. I don't really buy it.
What do you think, Jim?
I think he understood that procedurally it's probably really hard to sue the NFL. So what were his avenues as an owner? I think the conspiracy theory is that by accepting this, perhaps Tom Brady will go and knock on Goodell's door and ask for a 2-game suspension and everyone will be a little bit happier. And I do have some employees in my office who have claimed to me that, in fact, Bob Kraft is not a human being. He is a spineless jellyfish.
I see. All right. Well, in fact, this idea of Tom Brady knocking on Pat Goodell's door and saying, you know, how about it? You know, let's bring my suspension down. There are some folks, including Patriots player Matt Light, who suggested that's precisely the deal that's on the table here, or that's going to be on the table. That is, the Patriots take the punishment and we'll go easier on Brady. But there's no indication that that's the case. But what do you think, Dante? Possibility?
Sure, it's a possibility.
Okay.
I got nothing else.
Okay, that's fine. Well, all the air is out of this one, I guess. So let's move on to our hubbubs and those stories that might not have made it to the top of the news this week, but certainly caught the attention of our Week in Review team. Dante, give us your hubbub.
Mine is about the Daily Table, which is a new not-for-profit grocery store in Dorchester. Every day, big supermarket chains throw out lots of food that's perfectly good because it is approaching a sell-by date, which doesn't necessarily reflect the appropriateness or the safety of the food. Meanwhile, there are a lot of people out there who go hungry or eat poorly because they don't have access to healthy food. And Daily Table's founder, a former Trader Joe's executive named Doug Rausch, is hoping to fix that, using one problem to solve another. The store is going to use essentially the best of what is available from other stores and resell it at rock-bottom prices. And this has become a little bit of a Rorschach test. There are people out there who feel like it will foist inferior goods upon the poor. Some people, myself included, see, on the other hand, a useful experiment. And if Rausch can overcome a stigma, then he might have just hit upon a great way to fight hunger and reduce waste.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. We've had Doug Rausch in a couple of times talking about this. This is a store that opens in Dorchester, right?
Correct.
Yeah, right. Jim, what's your hubbub?
This one will surprise you because it's actually about sports and a sport that I like because, I'm not a big sports fan. Even as all eyes are on the troubled Olympic prize and Cambridge works to steal our Slide the City, that 1,000-foot water slide ride out from under Boston's nose, oh, Boston, have no fear. There is still the Grand Prix, and it is coming to the Seaport District Labor Day weekend. It's noble. The storied race has roots that go back to the late 19th century in France. It's fast. The race is pure speed. It's Indy 500 here in our backyard, and it's crazy in a really good way. These are F1 cars going to be zipping along Congress Street, Fargo, Cypher Streets. That's a sport I can get behind.
That'll be fun. I feel like I need to make some joke about Boston drivers here, but none is coming to me. So I'll just go into my hubbub, and it is about Tom Brady and the Patriots, as we know, support for Brady, despite Deflategate, has taken a hit during this scandal. But he's got a lot of support here in New England, including from former Senator Scott Brown's daughter, Ayla Brown, who, among other things, sings. So this is her song entitled, "I Just Want to Free Tom Brady."
I don't care if your ball's deflated.
Oh, man.
I just want to see my man playing. Can tell my friend, give him a break. It was just an honest mistake.
All right, so there's Ayla Brown, the daughter of former Senator Scott Brown, with her song, "I Just Want to Free Tom Brady." Where are they holding him anyway? I didn't even realize he needed to be freed, but there you have it. Dante Ramos, columnist for the op-ed page of the Boston Globe. Dante, thanks for coming and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you, Jim. Have a great
weekend.
It's
good to be with you.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, Joanne Chang joins us later in the program. She's Boston's top chef. She has a new cookbook about how to cook sweets with much less sugar. Stick with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.